This is Amarin's. Hi, everybody. This is Arthur. Welcome to episode 5 of my podcast. It's Friday, April 27th, and this week I'm talking about the lands down under, New Zealand and Australia. Now, that's, of course, why I picked that particular song to start this episode with, even though it's an Australian band, because this is a land down under as well. My first blog post was entitled, I Live in a Land Down Under. No, the other one. And it's The post was inspired, although I didn't actually talk about it in that post, the title was inspired by the fact that New Zealand is often sort of forgotten about when people talk about this part of the world, Americans in particular, talk about this part of the world. So I thought it might be worthwhile to spend a little while going over some of the differences between the two countries, my impressions of Australia as opposed to New Zealand, those sorts of things. Now, the countries are very different from one another, even though they're similar in some ways. I mean, they both have Queen Elizabeth as their head of state. They both have a parliamentary system. They have very similar flags. There's a long history of New Zealand and Australia fighting side by side in various wars. But the countries are quite different from each other. Australia is a lot bigger, both geographically and also in terms of population. It's something like 5 times our size, something like that. And its dynamic is different, I guess you could say. Now, historically, of course, Australia began life as a prison colony, and New Zealand didn't. And in Australia, there was more of a concerted effort to subdue the Aborigines, the indigenous peoples. And in New Zealand, the Crown made a treaty with the indigenous peoples, the Māori, and it's a partnership that exists to this day. Whereas in Australia, they're still dealing with some of the legacy of the way they treated Aborigines in the olden times. More recently, at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, Australia decided to form a federation, and because previously each of the states and territories had been administered as colonies. And so they formed a federation, and at the time, the plan was that New Zealand would join this federation. The Prime Minister, I think he was still actually called the Premier of New Zealand at the time, was Richard Seddon, who was known as King Dick. And he was adamantly opposed to New Zealand becoming part of Australia. If anything, he wanted New Zealand to form its own empire in the South Pacific. He apparently was quite angry with Britain when it ceded Hawaii, which had been known as the Sandwich Islands, to the United States, because he felt that it should have been part of the empire that New Zealand would rule. He eventually persuaded Britain to annex the Cook Islands and to allow New Zealand to administer them. But that's as far as that ever went. So when the time came for Australia to form its federation, they drew up a constitution which named all of the colonies at the time, including New Zealand, but New Zealand didn't actually join the federation. Now what that means is that to this day, at any time, New Zealand could decide to become one of the states of Australia, should it so choose. Now, that ain't going to happen, to be blunt about it, for a lot of reasons. First and foremost, the cultures are very different. I mean, they've gone there, despite all of the similarities and despite their connections, the two countries have developed differently over the past 100 and some odd years. And it's highly improbable that there would be a circumstance that would drive the two countries together as one, because it would mean New Zealand joining Australia. And similarly, in the news lately, there's been revived talk about a common currency between New Zealand and Australia. And there was a survey that was released that said that nearly half of New Zealanders favored a common currency, and only about 40-odd percent of Australians did. Here's the catch. What the Australians have always made clear is that if there's a common currency between New Zealand and Australia, it would mean that New Zealand would have to adopt the Australian dollar. And that would mean that all monetary policy would be made in Canberra and not in Wellington. Now that has severe implications, because if things aren't going well in Australia and they have to raise interest rates because of whatever, because of their conditions, New Zealanders would be affected too, even though our conditions here might be completely different. So if the question had asked, would you be in favor of abandoning the New Zealand dollar and adopting the Australian dollar, I doubt very much that it would have gotten even 20-odd percent support here in New Zealand, because New Zealanders don't want to give up the New Zealand dollar. What they want is a new currency that both countries share in, and both countries, where both countries manage the monetary policy that underpins it. Well, that's not going to happen. The Australians have made that clear. And New Zealand has made clear that it's not about to adopt the Australian currency and surrender monetary policy to the Australians. So there isn't going to be any joint currency in the foreseeable future. Now, personally, I think that one day what would be nice is if there was some sort of European Union-style arrangement in the South Pacific, where we had a common currency in the region, and maybe even a federated alliance sort of thing along the lines of the European Union without actual formal merger between the countries. Now, I have no idea whether that's going to ever happen either, but that personally is what I would like to see someday in the perhaps distant future. But for the time being, things are going to remain pretty much as they have been. Now, speaking of surveys, last week I talked about a gay neighbors survey, and I was suspicious about it. Well, I have to say that I found out a little bit more about it since last week's show, and my suspicions haven't really changed very much. First, Mark at Slap Upside the Head emailed me a link to a story in the National Post in Canada about the Canadians' views of the whole survey thing. But one of the things that's interesting about that is that Mark had actually done a post on Slap Upside the Head back in February about this. February 12th it was. And I'm going to put a link in the show notes, and it's really quite funny because he says that the likely culprit for the anti-gay attitude is garden jealousy. And you really have to check it out because it's quite funny. But it was obviously a story in Canada way back in February, but it only becomes a story here and in the U.S. in April. You know, what's that about? Well, as it happens, the day after I posted last week's show, Joe My God did a post on this subject as well. And again, I'll put a link in the show notes. And I had in my comments, I don't often comment on Joe My God's blog for a variety of reasons, but I did take exception to some of this time. And one of his posters went to the trouble of getting the rest of the results for the countries, because I said the big countries weren't listed. And what it said was, last week I had said how Australia, the 24.7% of Australians wouldn't want a gay neighbor. Well, you go down two clicks, and there's USA at 22.9% not wanting gay neighbors, and right behind them is New Zealand at 22.3% not wanting gay neighbors. Now, I'm sorry, there is no way that New Zealand is only slightly less homophobic than the US. It just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So I started looking into this a little bit more. Again, commentators provided various links. And it turns out that the survey isn't about gay neighbors as such, or values, or anything like that. It's actually just part of ongoing research that they do, and this was one of the things that they looked at. Okay, fair enough, I suppose. But it turns out that the numbers are from 1999 to 2001. So the numbers are quite old now. And the report apparently was released in 2002. So again, I'm asking, why is this suddenly news now, 5 years later? But one of the things that struck me about it was that the report said that the United States was among the least, like among Western nations, the U.S. was among the least likely to not want Muslims as neighbors. Now, I have to admit I raised an eyebrow about that until I found out how old the numbers were. And certainly if the numbers in America were collected prior to September 11th, 2001, that would explain it, but I doubt very much that you would find such Muslim-friendly numbers in America now. And most of these numbers actually would be probably quite a bit different if you were to check them now, because things have changed since 1999. It's basically silliness, I suppose, is what I'm saying. And I still believe that the numbers are invalid because they're old, and we don't know their methodology. I presume from looking at their reports that they used typical social science research methods where they would interview people, but there's no indication about how they selected the people that they interviewed. I mean, if they were to hang out at the local Baptist church, the results would be completely different than if they were to hang out in a gay neighborhood somewhere, for instance. So my main criticism, however, was that the numbers are extremely old, and also the fact that they don't reveal their methodology in any great detail, which prompted Joe My God to add, "All good points, Arthur. I'd love to see a more current version of this study too," which I have to admit kind of thrilled me, because he's never posted a comment on any of my comments before, so I thought that was kind of fun. I have to admit that. But the survey, I think, is really suspect, and I personally wouldn't waste any more time thinking about it, because the numbers are not valid. Unless the researchers can provide some evidence that those numbers are still valid and that their methodology is solid, I would say it's all a bunch of nonsense. And I'm sorry, but until they convince me otherwise, I think it's all a bunch of silliness. Unfortunately, however, it's going to get quoted probably a lot by the right-wing media and by right-wing commentators who want to show that gay people aren't welcomed and therefore they should be discriminated against, or some silliness like that. Anyway, that's slightly off the topic of Australia and New Zealand, but the main point there is that Australia came out as being more homophobic than New Zealand, which may or may not be the case. I honestly don't have a whole lot of experience with homophobia in Australia. I don't have any personal experience with homophobia in Australia. I do know that their current prime minister is quite hostile to gay people and gay relationships. When the Australian Capital Territory, which is a bit like District of Columbia in America, when they moved to sanction gay relationships, the prime minister and his government intervened to make sure that wouldn't happen. Because they could, basically. And they have in the past opposed any recognition of same-sex relationships. They went out of their way to outlaw same-sex marriage in Australia, even though it's not really a federal issue. Nevertheless, he got involved in it. Historically, he does a lot of the same things that come from the Karl Rove playbook. And a lot of these neoconservatives talk back and forth with each other, and they've got connections. And so it's not actually an accident that his campaign and his methods are so similar. Nevertheless, I don't know that how close the attitudes toward gay and lesbian people are between New Zealand and Australia, although I would suspect that Australia is more homophobic than New Zealand. Historically, at least in recent history, Australia has had a problem with race and ethnic clashes. It, at the moment, has some issues with Muslims, and they've also, over time, at various other times, had issues with Greek immigrants and Italian immigrants and Asian immigrants and all sorts of different people. Because remember, at one time, Australia had what they called a White Australia policy, which was to encourage immigration from European countries that had white people in it. And that, of course, was abandoned quite a while ago, but not that long ago in the overall scheme of things. So Australia, and I mean, I don't want to create the impression that Australia is some jackbooted, racist nation, because it isn't. It's anything but. But there is an undercurrent that still exists, is what I'm trying to say. It's made tremendous strides over the past 10 years, say, but it has a long way to go, especially as compared to some other countries. It might arguably be better overall in Australia than it is in many parts of America. However, they have a major issue in reconciling with Aborigines and Torres Strait Islanders. But ultimately, it's something they're going to have to come to terms with. And I don't know. I honestly don't know how that is all going to play out in the end, but it is certainly very different from the way things are here, which, again, is not to say that New Zealand is a paradise, because it isn't. There are issues here that have to be dealt with. Maori and Polynesians figure on all the wrong end of all the statistics: health, crime, longevity, all those sorts of things. Historically, Maori and Pacific Islanders have been an underclass, which is partly why they're on the wrong end of all those statistics. Archer had asked about in the comments of an earlier show if there is discrimination against Maori, and there is in some ways, in some places. Of course, actual discrimination is illegal in New Zealand in employment, housing, all those sorts of things. And no one would blatantly discriminate against anyone for those causes. Certainly not if there's any likelihood of them being caught, and there probably is a high likelihood of them being caught. However, having said that, the schools in areas where Maori tend to be concentrated are not as good as schools in other areas. Not because the schools themselves are failing, but just because of the crushing weight of the poverty that's around them. It's part of what led to busing in America. It wasn't just about race, which is what a lot of people assumed. It was also about breaking up monolithic classes, and by classes I mean economic classes. So in America, you might have a school that was all black, but it was also all poor, and they wanted to have not just mix of races, but also mix of social and economic classes, so that people could interact more and they could learn from each other and develop and grow and those sorts of things. Well, we don't have busing or anything like that here. As a matter of fact, under the Labour government, each child has the right to go to their closest school. However, some of the poorer schools do struggle because of the crushing poverty that's around them. It's a very complicated issue, and I really am not qualified to go into it in any great depth. But the main point is just to say that New Zealand is certainly not a paradise, because it's no country is, actually. However, its problems are nothing like Australia's or America's. And there is, underneath everything, this existing written partnership between the Crown and Māori, which means that the government is obligated to try to do what it can to lift up Māori, and also other disadvantaged peoples, like Pacific Islanders, for instance. And hopefully one day they'll get there. Whether they will or not, I don't know. But overall, race relations in New Zealand are pretty darn healthy and pretty darn strong. There's a position in government called the Race Relations Conciliator, who doesn't actually close down debate or anything like that, but tries to build bridges between different communities who may not understand one another. Sometimes it's an ethnic clash. It might be, say, I can't think off the top of my head, but it's particularly active among immigrant groups who may not understand that the way things are in New Zealand is different than from where they came from. That New Zealand is built on tolerance and understanding, and it's built on community, I suppose you'd say. And I mean that in the broadest sense of the word, that you don't just take your ways, your bigotries with you into New Zealand. You're supposed to leave them behind and start over here. Well, that's part of what the Race Relations Conciliator does. It's more complicated than that as well, of course, but that sort of gives you an idea that there is at least an effort to try to bring people together, an official effort to try to bring people together. Now, there's one other thing about Australia that I wanted to mention, which I think is one of the most bizarre things I've ever encountered in my life. And that is television commercials. When I first arrived in New Zealand, I saw commercials which I knew were American commercials because I'd just seen them on American television, except they all had Australian accents. I looked at the commercial more closely, and you could see that the syncing was off. The mouth didn't quite match what words were being said. And I, for the life of me, couldn't figure out what that was all about, because New Zealanders don't really care about the commercials. We have ones from America, we have ones from Britain, and we have ones from Australia, Australian-made commercials. And then there were these funny ones that were American-made, but dubbed with Australian voices. So I started asking about that, and Kiwi said, and I stress, this is Kiwis telling me this, that Australians are extremely nationalistic and that they don't like foreign goods, imported goods, and if the voices were foreign, in this case American, that they would be less likely to buy the product, that they needed it to be with Australian accents in order for them to consider it worth their time and effort and more importantly, money. Now, I don't know if that's true. I would really love to hear from some Australians to tell me if there's actually any truth in that or if it's just a bunch of nonsense. But unless somebody's got a better explanation of why the Australians would go to all the trouble of redubbing commercials with Australian voice actors, that's as good an explanation as any, I suppose. it's really freaky. You have to see it for yourself. Now, on some totally different matters, first of all, I mentioned last week that I'd added a Frapper map. And Archer was the first to put his pin on my map. And I've also had a pin from Andrew of I Say, and Michael from QCast Connecticut, and Dan, who's from Sacramento, and also Washington Brian. But that's been about it so far. So I would like to encourage you to put your pin on my map. It is just a bunch of fun. It doesn't mean or do anything, but it's just kind of fun to see where people are from and all that. And I'm getting a bit jealous of QCast Connecticut because, well, they also have a special theme song for their Frapper Mappers. But they're getting all kinds of people to put pins on their map, and I just don't have that many yet. So do put your pin on my map. I thought at this point I would talk about some of the comments from last month. Now, I haven't, as a general rule, read the comments, and one of the reasons is I always figured out people could read the comments for themselves, except then it recently dawned on me that not everybody who listens to the podcast also reads the blog or goes to my blog. So I'm going to highlight the comments. I'm not going to necessarily read every word, but at least give you the gist of it. So the first one was from Condo Blogger, who said that he discovered the podcast from Real Men Wear Pink, who, by the way, steered a lot of traffic to my blog, so I'd like to thank them very much for that. I want to highlight about that? He said that, I'm totally hooked. It's always been a dream of mine to live abroad, and as I get older, it becomes less and less practical proposition. However, so it's really great to get a feeling for what it's like from you. Well, I think, of course, and I actually said this in my reply, that it's never too late to go anywhere. And basically what I think is that people should do what makes them happy, and if that means moving to another country, by all means, go for it. In my case, I did not want to go through my life wondering what if, and I had to take the chance, and I suppose it's what you would call a leap of faith. And I took the risk, and things worked out very well for me. And they don't work out for everybody. A lot of the Americans who come here end up going back home or on to some other country. And I'm sure that's true for other ethnicities as well. But it's certainly something that's worth trying. So, I don't know. But he says, by the way, I didn't hear any Kiwi accent until you mentioned that some other people hear it in your voice. Then I did start picking it out now and then. Mostly I hear a Midwest accent. He says, not nearly as thick as JT's, though. the accent thing is a bit funny. Some people hear it, some people don't. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. I just know that there are some things that have changed in the nearly 12 years that I've been here. Archer thanked me for my shout-out, which he thoughtfully puts in quote marks, since I have still real trouble using that phrase. And he also says that he's always hot, so he rarely uses heat, but runs the air conditioning in the summer. Now, last week, of course, I did talk about heating options in New Zealand and how it was difficult originally to get air conditioning when we moved here, and that's all different now. Well, last weekend, Nigel and I went to a home show where they had a few, and I stress few, dealers in air conditioning, heating air conditioning. And we've got some people coming around to give us quotes on and gives options of various sorts. The first one is on Monday. And so hopefully within a few weeks we'll know which direction we're going and I'll be able to report that. But at this stage we're still just collecting quotes on the most efficient system, because what we want, as I said before, basically is one that will heat and cool and you be the most energy efficient and most practical for our particular house. So we'll see what comes up with that. Archer also said that the history of Anzac Day was very interesting. I really know nothing about the history of New Zealand and enjoy learning about it. Before I came here, I didn't know a whole lot about New Zealand. I knew some because in university I'd had a course on the Commonwealth, a political science course. So I'd studied a little bit. I knew about the Statues of Westminster and other various bits and pieces. But my particular history of New Zealand wasn't as solid as it could have been, I suppose. And as I said, I think it was episode one, when I first moved here, one of the things I did was start reading history so that I could get a feel for what other people already knew. Calvin, who is one of my most favorite podcasters, and anybody who listens to Hello Waffles podcast may get that little inside reference. Anyway, he says, I really enjoyed your description of Anzac Day. He said he was surprised by the statistics of that survey, but he'd be curious to know precisely how the question was asked. And I still don't know specifically how the question was asked, except that it was in the context of a social science survey, and along with a whole bunch of other things, apparently. So the question itself may not have mattered quite as much as how they selected their samples and those sorts of things. Dee from Wellington says, you know, I still can't hear your accent, which is interesting. As I said, there's a division of opinion on that. I suppose that if she'd heard my accent originally, she'd probably be able to hear it more now, because when I arrived here, I had a pretty, not strong isn't quite the word I'm looking for, a ordinary Midwest, upper Midwest accent from the Chicago area. It wasn't a Chicago accent, because that is completely different, but it was typical for northeastern Illinois. And except for a few points, because even when I lived in that state, I didn't say Illinois like a lot of the folks there do. I always said Illinois, and I don't know why. But I've always been a bit of a pack rat when it comes to accents, and I've been influenced by people that I've known, places that I've lived. I went to school at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. I think I just said Illinois, too. Anyway, their accent is a bit like Memphis, a bit like Southwest Missouri, a bit like Southern Indiana, a bit like this, a bit like that. So I had little inflections of that for a while after I left school. And one of my friends there was from Memphis, and so I picked up things that he would say. Like he said he'd be fixing to do something, so for a while I'd said that as well. So I suppose it's not surprising that I have now picked up Kiwi things as well. It's just that I can't always hear it either. Anyway, Dee goes on, we've been here, they live in Wellington, since November, and while there were times it was very cold in our temporary housing, there was maybe one day in summer where the house was a bit too warm. It's always windy here. Wellington is known as Windy Wellington, by the way. It's always windy here, though, so we just make sure to keep the windows open throughout the summer month, February. That's a bit of a sarcastic remark, because this was not exactly a warm, hot summer this year. It was a bit on the cool side often, and I think Wellington got more than its fair share of bad weather this year. But she says they're soon going to buy a heater for their living room, which is usually called a lounge in New Zealand. Although so far the apartment has held the heat from the sun quite well, and no matter the temperature outside, and it's probably probably due to it being a new building, and it probably is. Newer buildings obviously are better suited for that sort of thing than older buildings. So those are the comments from last week, and as I said, basically, I didn't actually read every word. In some cases, I admit, I sort of paraphrased. But you get the general idea. Now, finally, starting next week, I'm going to be doing a part-time job on Wednesdays and Thursdays, my time, which doesn't affect this show at all because I record it on Fridays. But it does mean that I can't be part of Archer's group shows anymore because it records on Thursday, my time. So I've been toying with the idea of adding a second show of my own in the first part of the week. I don't know specifically what day, and I don't even know specifically what format, although I was thinking that I might do discussions with other people on those shows. So I'd sort of like to know what you think. Do you think it's a bad idea and you wouldn't want another show no matter what? Or do you think it's a great idea and you can't wait for it? Or do you just not care one way or the other? That's okay too. I'm just looking for some guidance on that because I certainly don't want to start doing that if nobody's interested in it. And on the other hand, if people are indifferent or do want it, then it's something I'm going to pursue doing. I thought, among other things, that I might talk to some American expats here in New Zealand, apart from myself, because mine obviously isn't the only perspective on these issues, and other things like that. So let me know what you think. Always feel free to leave a comment on my blog, which is amarins.blogspot.com, or you can flick me an email. That's just for you, Dee. You can flick me an email to amarins@yahoo.com or amarins@gmail.com. They both work. And that's it for this week. I will talk to you all next week. Have a great weekend, and see you later.